content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we'll begin with an article titled The Cuneiform Challenge by Joshua Hammer. In the 1850s, the world's oldest writing system was a series of baffling scratches on clay. Then four fiercely competitive scholars solved the mystery. On a late summer day in 1856, a letter carrier stepped from a mail coach in front of a three-story townhouse in Mayfair in central London. Crossing the threshold, the courier handed a wax-sealed envelope to a clerk. The missive was addressed to Edwin Norris, the secretary of the Royal Asiatic Society of Great Britain and Ireland, one of Europe's leading research institutions. The postman had no way of knowing that the envelope could help rewrite the story of civilization's origins and ignite a contest for international renown. At stake, immortality conferred on those who make a once-in-a-century intellectual breakthrough. Three men, driven by boundless curiosity, a love of risk, and the distinctive demons of aspiration and ambition, were most responsible for making the contest possible. One, Austin Henry Layard, was the son of an English colonial civil servant. At age 22, he had fled the drudgery of clerkship in his uncle's law office for a life of adventure on the back roads of the Ottoman Empire. Bandits robbed him three times and once left him to wander half-naked and barefoot through the desert. He joined a rebellious mountain tribe in Persia and spied in the Balkans for the British ambassador in Constantinople. At last, he reached the mounds of Mesopotamia, where he transformed himself into one of the most celebrated archaeologists of the age. Henry Creswick Rawlinson, living in the shadow of an accomplished older brother, decided early that he would carve his own identity in exile. As a 23-year-old military officer of the East India Company, he found himself in Persia. There, he demonstrated a flair for languages, a skill at scaling heights in search of millennia-old inscriptions, and a powerful yearning, he confided to his sister, to do something to attract the world's attention. In his early 30s, he deciphered the writing of the ancient Persian Empire. The achievement brought Rawlinson his first taste of fame, and more dead languages were waiting to be understood. Finally, there was Edward Hinks, a country person in a remote corner of Ireland. Brilliant but tormented by paralyzing anxiety and the specter of financial ruin. Hinks was hungry for peer recognition of his linguistic gifts. Huddled at his rectory desk, he had translated obscure documents written in Egyptian hieroglyphs and ancient Hebrew. Eventually, he set his sights on the most tantalizing prize of them all. By 1856, the paths of these three men had converged in a sometimes friendly, often combustible pas de trois. Now, with Layard watching from a judicious distance, Hinks and Rawlinson were about to become the prime contestants in a challenge to determine once and for all whether the oldest writing system in the world could be deciphered. However esoteric that might sound, the question was the subject of intense public debate in capitals on both sides of the Atlantic. For mid-19th century Britons, proving that this elusive script could be understood meant pulling back the curtain on a distant, vanished yet hauntingly familiar world, one that had given birth to humanity's modern mind. Until the 1840s, few Europeans knew anything about the great civilizations that began their rise along the Tigris and Euphrates rivers around 2000 BC. Assyria and its vassal state and sometimes rival, Babylon had dominated the Near East and beyond. Classical writers described Assyria, which reached its zenith around 700 BC, as the first true empire. Herodotus wrote that Babylon, quote, surpasses in splendor any city in the known world, end quote. But in the late 7th century BC, a coalition of enemies destroyed Assyria, and Babylon was neglected, ransacked, and left to die out 500 years later. Quote, today the greatest world city of antiquity is a mound of desert earth, end quote, one theologian wrote. By the mid-1800s, these societies have been almost entirely forgotten. At the British Museum, the world's preeminent repository of antiquities, many seized without the permission of the nations on whose soil they were found, the relics of Assyria and Babylon, including writings inscribed on clay bricks and stone, filled a single 3-square-foot cabinet. But excavations at Pompeii and Herculaneum had inspired a new science, investigating antiquity by digging objects out of the earth. And Layard was one of its most spectacularly successful practitioners, enduring lethal epidemics, stultifying heat, vermin-infested camps, and the hostility of Ottoman authorities. He made a series of discoveries beginning in the mid-1840s in what is now northern Iraq. 2,500-year-old Assyrian palaces, paneled with exquisite alabaster bas-reliefs, guarded by stone gods and monsters. In vivid detail, the friezes depicted corpse-covered battlefields, battering ram-wielding soldiers breaking down city ramparts, archers in stallion-drawn chariots, bedraggled captives, vassals bearing tributes, kings attended by eunuchs, and royal lion hunts in the bush. Unreadable inscriptions swirled around the carvings. Layard and his protege, a Christian Arab from Mosul named Hormuz Rassam, also unearthed thousands of inscribed clay tablets in the royal library of the Assyrian king Sennacherib at Nineveh. Layard, Rassam, and other researchers guessed that the tablets were filled with information about astronomy, medicine, religion, politics, law, and everyday life in the Assyrian Empire. The rediscovery of this lost civilization seized the public's imagination. Hundreds of thousands of people flocked to the Crystal Palace in South London in 1854 to gaze at the Nineveh court, a fanciful reinvention of the royal palace, with lotus gardens, multicolored bas-reliefs, and blue-headed bull capitals perched atop Doric columns. Newspapers chronicled the arrival in England of giant winged lions and other stone colossi that testified to Assyria's artistic mastery and rich mythology. Today, whisking away priceless cultural objects violates every standard of archaeology. International law largely prohibits it. But at the time, such rules and norms weren't in place, and people were thrilled to see the relics. Quote, the monuments Layard has sent home from the plains of Assyria, excited a livelier interest than anything else I saw in the museum, end quote, wrote an American visitor in Mississippi's Natchez Courier. Quote, there they are, disinterred from the oblivion of ages, the last survivors, the sole historic monuments of Nineveh, her kings and her people and her glory, end quote. For the first time, too, the museum-going and reading public could examine large samples of the vanished civilization's writing system, a script that predated Egyptian hieroglyphics by centuries. Assyrian and Babylonian scribes had ingeniously used the thick stem of a reed that grows in the wetlands of the Middle East, the Arundo Donax, and split these stalks to create a trapezoidal tip. Then they pressed signs into damp clay and fired the inscribed tablets in a kiln, making them almost indestructible. Over time, scribes also carved the characters into copper and stone. Cuneiform, the term derives from the Latin cuneus, or wedge, referring to the characters' distinctive shapes, lacked the artfulness of hieroglyphs. The contemporary science writer Edward Dolnick has said that the signs looked like, quote, what you might get if a flock of birds with obsessive-compulsive disorder took a walk across wet clay, end quote. But the writing system had taken over the ancient world. It employed both phonetic characters and logograms, or pictorial symbols, meant to represent a whole word, and could be used to write different languages. From Mesopotamia, cuneiform had traveled east around 2000 BC to the kingdom of Elam on the plains of Persia. A few centuries later, the kingdom Urartu, southeast of the Black Sea and dominated by the biblical Mount Ararat, where Noah's Ark was said to come to rest after the flood, adopted the system for its own language, as did the Hittite Empire in Anatolia, present-day Turkey, that reached its zenith during the mid-14th century BC. A simplified form took hold in Ugarit, a prosperous city-state on the Mediterranean coast in present-day Syria. Finally, it was embraced by the Persian-speaking Achaemenid Empire, which, under King Cyrus, Darius, and Xerxes, ruled Central Asia and parts of Africa and Europe from the 6th century to the 4th century BC. The wedge-based script endured for some 2,500 years, but papyrus gradually supplanted clay, making new scripts made cuneiform obsolete, and the 15 languages that it used died out. The last datable cuneiform tablet, found in the early 1900s in southern Mesopotamia, is an astronomical almanac predicting the appearances of stars, planets, and other heavenly bodies, inscribed around AD 75. By the 2nd century AD, knowledge of the phonetic values and meaning of the characters had faded away. European travelers first encountered cuneiform in the early 17th century. In the 1760s, examining hundreds of cuneiform inscriptions in the ancient Persian city of Persepolis, a young German named Karsten Niebuhr deduced that the inscriptions were written in three languages, although he couldn't interpret what any said. All three inscriptions used wedges, but the characters were different. One language, which would soon come to be recognized as Old Persian, used just 42 phonetic characters and pictographs. Another, later identified as Elamite, had about 130 signs. The third, and most complex, with about 700 signs, will become known as Akkadian, named after a city-state that flourished in southern Mesopotamia between around 2300 and 2100 BC, and used by the Assyrians and Babylonians. Niebuhr was convinced that each set of trilingual texts said the same thing, but he didn't go any further than that. He considered himself a geographer, a scientist, and an artist, not a decipherer. In the 1820s, the Englishman Thomas Young and his rival, Frenchman Jean-François Champollion, solved the riddle of the hieroglyphs by using the Greek text on the trilingual Rosetta Stone as a launching point for deciphering Egyptian pictographs. Scholars could now read the love poetry and funerary texts of ancient Egyptians, study the military campaigns of the pharaohs, and learn how the dwellers along the Nile treated toothaches, performed surgeries, and measured time. But even the most adept philologists could see that cuneiform presented bigger challenges than hieroglyphs. Egyptian logograms often looked like the objects they were meant to stand for: an eagle, a duck, a beetle, a pyramid. Or they conveyed an idea through an illustration that, in at least a vague way, related to their meaning. A teetering diagonal wall, for instance, represented falling. A lute-like musical instrument was meant to symbolize joy or pleasure. Akkadian, which was an entirely abstract script, proved no such clues to signs' meanings. Now, in the 1850s, following Layard's finds, the public clamored for linguists to unravel the mysteries of cuneiform too. Religious believers were thrilled by the possibility that the royal annals of Babylon and of Assyria's capitals at Nineveh and Nimrud might corroborate tales from the Old Testament. The Hebrew prophets, for example, had described how Assyria had deported 10 Israelite tribes from Samaria in 721 BC and its siege of Jerusalem 20 years later. These accounts were not corroborated by other surviving records, however, and at a time when atheists, agnostics, and other post-Enlightenment skeptics were casting doubt on Scripture, the writing could turn out to prove the veracity of the Word of God. And cuneiform dangled the possibility of peering back even further in time. New excavations along the Euphrates in southern Mesopotamia had turned up tablets written in cuneiform that appeared to predate the finds at Nineveh by nearly 2,000 years, originating around 2500 BC. The characters were familiar, but the language seemed different. If this far more ancient script were deciphered, it would offer insights into the cradle of civilization, which would become to be known as Sumer. In this flat, fertile zone, humans established the first permanent communities, developed agriculture, scratched out pictures of objects that became writing, and slowly organized themselves into complex hierarchical societies that remain recognizable today. Could it truly be possible to read records preserved from this distant time? In the 1850s, both Rawlinson and Hinks, after years of stumbling into linguistic dead ends, claimed to be making great progress understanding the Arrowhead script. Hinks had taken the first great strides in deciphering Akkadian cuneiform in 1846. By searching for the names of ancient Persian kings in the parallel inscriptions that Niebuhr had found in Persepolis. He believed the names would have been pronounced approximately the same way in Old Persian and Akkadian. Hinks, Rawlinson, and other linguists had separately deciphered Old Persian, so he lined it up with the Akkadian signs, just as Thomas Young had matched ancient Greek letters with hieroglyphs. Hinks had obtained the approximate phonetic value of more than 100 Akkadian characters this way. The same year, Hinks also noticed that 7-character phonetic spelling of the word king in Old Persian became a single character when it was written in Akkadian. This gave him, he believed, his first Akkadian logogram, though it would take him several years before he figured out how to pronounce the word. Well before Rawlinson, Hinks grasped that Akkadian writing, like hieroglyphs, consisted of both phonetic symbols and logograms. Hinks had also been way ahead of Rawlinson in recognizing that Akkadian was a Semitic language and was closely related to Hebrew, another language in which Hinks was fluent. By the early 1850s, Rawlinson had largely caught up with Hinks. Scholars, literary journals, and the public marveled at both men's supposed insights. But even as their rivalry between the decipherers grew more intense, they agreed on one thing. The writing of Babylon and Assyria was bewilderingly complex. Its most striking characteristic was what was called polyphony. Many characters, they maintained, could be read in 6, 7, 8, even 8 different ways. Skeptics accused Hinks and Rawlinson of perpetuating a hoax to cover up their befuddlement. If this claim were true, one critic point out, then the 8-character name that Hinks claimed meant Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian king who had captured Jerusalem around 586 BC, could be read in no fewer than 393,216 ways. Given such confusion, it was widely feared that the writing would never be cracked. But in 1854, a unique opportunity presented itself. Layard's protege, Rassam, had discovered a relic buried beneath a temple in what was believed to be the oldest Assyrian capital, Ashur, in the semi-desert 40 miles south of Mosul. The octagonal column, known as a prism, was inscribed with 800 lines of tiny cuneiform characters. It was believed to date to 1100 BC, a time when war was raging between the Greeks and Trojans, and the prophet Samuel led the Israelites to victory against the Philistines. The cylinder was sent to the British Museum. It is still on display there. Rawlinson, who had close ties to the museum, was working on an official translation, and the institution planned to publish it as soon as it was done. As he proceeded, a wealthy investor with a passion for intellectual puzzles burst onto the scene. William Henry Fox Talbot had made his name 2 decades earlier by devising a method for fixing images from life onto chemically treated light-sensitive paper. The breakthrough had earned him a nickname, quote-unquote, the father of photography, which he shared with the Frenchman Louis-Jacques Mondé Daguerre. Talbot had lately devoted himself to a new enthusiasm, Assyrio-Babylonian decipherment. Talbot dispatched a letter, the letter that would change everything, to London's Royal Asiatic Society, offering to send his own translation and have a panel of judges compare his work with Rawlinson's. If the versions turned out to be identical or even close, it must indicate that they have truth for their basis, he wrote. After a negotiation with Rawlinson and the British Museum, Talbot received a lithograph copy of the inscriptions in January 1856 and got to work. On March 21st, 24 members of the society converged on 5 New Burlington Street for their regular Saturday conclave, filing through the spacious interior, checking their top hats and coats, and making their way to a ground floor gallery. Sitting in the room was another man, a guest, a 31-year-old classicist and adventurer named Julius Oppert. Born in Hamburg, Oppert was a descendant of Samuel Oppenheimer, a wealthy Jewish banker. After he was denied a position at German universities because of institutional anti-Semitism, Oppert had joined a 3-year French archaeological expedition in Babylon and northern Mesopotamia. Now, his star was on the rise, and he asked if he could undertake a translation as well. By affording 3 independent versions of the same document, he argued, an agreement among the decipherers could be even more persuasive. But what about Hinks? The churchman had a fraught relationship with Rawlinson, which was marked by accusations of stolen credit, public disputes, and a private snub by the British Museum that had cost Hinks part of his livelihood. Edwin Norris, the Society's secretary, was determined to give Hinks his due, and he recommended that the Society dispatch lithographs of the text to the reclusive pastor at his rectory in Killyleagh, south of Belfast. Norris proposed a 2-month deadline for all the submissions. At that point, a 6-man panel of judges, including some of the most renowned historians and linguists in England, would compare the 4 translations. Norris fixed a meeting of the Royal Asiatic Society for Wednesday, May 20th, when the 4 sealed packets could be opened before witnesses and the literary inquest could take place. For Rawlinson, Talbot, Oppert, and Hinks, this was no ordinary race to the finish line. To convince the public that their translations weren't hoaxes, they all had to be right in their interpretations. Each still hoped to be the most right, but they knew their competitors couldn't be far behind. The stakes were huge. They could immortalize their names in the field of linguistic archaeology, unlocking the secrets of the world's first great civilizations, or they could humiliate themselves before their peers, the government, and a global public. The game was on. The 3,000-year-old enigmatic prism that the esteemed linguists would now attempt independently to transliterate and translate was about the height of a bowling pin. Rawlinson, who had gotten the jump on everyone else while ensconced as the British ambassador in Baghdad in the mid-1850s, claimed that its 800 lines of Akkadian language cuneiform script contained the annals of Tiglath-Pileser I, who had expanded the Assyrian Empire to Syria and the Mediterranean Sea around 1100 BC. He also maintained that they chronicled the king's military campaigns, building projects, temple consecrations, hunting expeditions, and tributes paid by vassals from far-flung corners of the empire. All were described with tiny characters pressed together on a 16-inch high fired clay column held together by gum water and chalk. Now, the 3 other participants in the challenge would either back up his initial claims or show them to be pure hogwash. Over the next 3 weeks, Norris assembled his panel of judges. None considered himself an expert in Semitic tongues, but that didn't matter. Their job was to compare the 4 participants' English translations, note similarities and discrepancies, and confirm that the versions sent in were made independently, the seals of the translators having been broken in their presence. Norris wrote that he had confidence in the decipherers and expected the 4 versions would closely resemble one another. Yet, whether Oppert's and Hinks' translations were any good seemed almost, to the corner of the British establishment, of little importance. Oppert's participation stemmed from the fact that he'd happened to be a guest of the Society in March when Talbot's challenge was announced. As for Hinks, he was an outsider brought in at the last minute. In fact, the lithographed copy of the cylinder finally arrived at Hinks's rectory only on April 26, inexplicably after more than a month of preparation by the British Museum. By then, the parson had 18 days to submit his translation to the Society. "I will translate as much as I can," he wrote to Talbot, "but the time allowed is so short that I shall probably not go through much more than half of the inscription." Embroiled in a bitter rivalry with Rawlinson, Hinks was almost certain that the diplomat, a proud, territorial, and sometimes ruthless figure, had sabotaged him by delaying the delivery of the inscriptions to Ireland. The parson had already accused Rawlinson of trying to steal credit for his scholarly insights. The pattern dated to 1849, when Hinks first recognized compound logograms in Akkadian, the juxtaposition of 2 logographic characters to make an entirely new word. For instance, son plus woman made daughter. Hinks had also spotted syllabaries, tablets made for aspiring scribes that listed logograms with their phonetic values, and a trove of inscriptions that Layard brought to Killyleagh in 1852. But Rollin insisted that he had found compound logograms before Hanks, and that he delivered syllabaries too, while poring through clay tablets in the library of Sennacherib at Nevea. Then there was a period in 1853 and 1854 when Hanks had spent fruitful months at the British Museum, inching closer, it appeared, to escaping from the obscurity of a rector's life in rural Ireland. Ensconced in the workroom in the museum's bowels, Hanks had labored hours at a stretch over the museum's prizes, filling notebooks with an outpouring of translations and annotations. But when his one-year employment agreement ended on June 6, 1854, the trustees delivered dismaying news. They were not renewing his contract. At Rawlinson, Hanks wondered, played a role in his ouster. Then there was the matter of his two black spiral notebooks, which in his hasty exit, he had left behind in his workroom. They contained, quote, a mass of information, which is, I flatter myself, indeed I have no doubt, of great value, end quote, he told Layard, who had become a confidant. He feared they would fall into Rawlinson's hands, quote, I have no doubt, he wrote to Layard, that he will be allowed to free access to all that the museum possesses. I am thus disheartened, end quote. And that's where we're going to stop this article today, and we will finish it next week because we've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.